Well, he's a seeker of the truth. And John Rappaport has put it all together in his new work called The Ownership of All Life, as he looks at what is going on this planet and how it affects all of us. We'll be back in a moment with John Rappaport on Coast to Coast AM. John Rappaport, widely regarded as one of the most important investigative medical reporters in the world. He's worked in the area for over 30 years. He's written articles on deep politics, health, medicine. Early in his career, John was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize by LA Weekly for his interview with the president of El Salvador University, where the military there had invaded the campus. He's been a regular contributor to Coast AM, and he is back. Here's John Rappaport. John, my friend, how are you?
Oh, good, George. How are you?
Good. Good to have you back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
What have you been doing in terms of investigations over the past couple of years?
Well, this book, The Ownership of All Life, I've got a story to tell tonight, and it goes all the way back to 1959, when I was a mere pup of
an investigative
21 years old in New York. And the story goes all the way up to the late 90s. And much of what's in the book and also in associated articles that I've been writing for many years and continue to write involves these experiences, rather strange experiences that I had. So in 1959, I had a very good friend who lived on the Upper East Side in New York, and I was invited over one night.
Mm-hmm.
Came upstairs all the way to the top floor, very beautiful view of the city, penthouse. Her father was a man named Telford Taylor, whom I didn't know from anybody. But rapidly, I found out as I was sitting there with my mouth open, watching a conversation go on, that he was one of the major prosecutors at the Nuremberg trials. He was a colonel in the army. And later I discovered that his job was the prosecution of corporate criminals, industrial criminals, not the military criminals, which trial did not receive the bulk of attention at the time. But that night, in the apartment, there was a conversation going on about a movie that was in preparation called Judgment at Nuremberg, which garnered at least a one Academy Award, a really big star movie. And sitting in the room was Maximilian Schell, the actor who mm-hmm. won an Academy Award for his portrayal of Hans Rolf, who was the defense attorney for the Nazis on trial. And I gathered that this was going to be a very adventurous script and movie. For example, one of the arguments that Hans Rolf was going to make was that Oliver Wendell Holmes was a proponent of eugenics in the United States. He was going to say this in the movie, and that this was a fact that had been lost on most Americans, and he was going to use that to try to justify what the defendants, the people he was defending, had done. And I sat there and watched this conversation going on between Telford Taylor and Max Schell for a couple of hours, and just kind of walked out of the place baffled, intrigued, kind of astounded. I had no idea that was going to happen that night in New York. And at the age of 21, didn't really know what to do with it. A few days later, out of the blue, I get a visit from an old man that I've never seen before, who knows that I've been in the apartment listening to that conversation.
And he found you somehow.
He found me.
Okay.
Well, he probably found me through my friend, although I'm still not sure of how this happened. I said, "Who are you?" He said, "Well, I'm just somebody who wants to talk to you." I would estimate that he was about, at the time, 75 years old.
And I bet your friend was either, let's see how clairvoyant I am here, Joan, Ellen, or Ursula?
Wow.
Pretty good, huh?
Wow. Ellen.
All right.
Ellen and Joan.
Not bad.
Gee.
I'll tell you about that.
Yeah. Wow, I've got to hear this one.
Yeah.
Okay. So he says to me, "I just want to talk to you. You listen. You know, again, I was astonished. He said, do you know what IG Farben is? I said, no, I have no idea. He said, well, it was the fourth leading or largest corporation in the world, really a cartel at the outbreak of World War II, Nazi cartel. It put Hitler over the top to become the Chancellor of Germany, and without its help, probably never would have happened. It was a chemical pharmaceutical cartel. And he went on to tell me things that I found out on my own many years later when books began to be published, that Farben had built a rubber factory right near Auschwitz in Poland, the concentration camp. And that's where Mengele was doing, famous Nazi doctor was doing his experiments. And some of those experiments on prisoners involved pairs of twins, 1,500 pairs of twins. He was doing genetic experiments to see if he could find out any differences genetically among these pairs of twins.
Yeah, and he was obsessed with stuff like that.
He was, because what he was looking for, he was trying to find the genetic basis of the master race. That's what his goal was. Of course, he assumed there was such a thing, and he did some, no one knows exactly, at least I have not seen the documents that detail exactly what these experiments were, but very few of these children survived. Almost all of them died. So he told me about this. And then he said, you know, this was a cartel which was evil incarnate, and Telford Taylor was the prosecutor at Nuremberg that was trying these men. And he went on to say a number of other things about Farben and so on. He got through. And I said, why in the world are you telling me this? And he said, because I understand that you're an intelligent young man and maybe someday you want to be a writer. He said, my work is to go around and talk to people. He said, that's all I do at this stage of my life. He said, I plant seeds. Someday you'll remember this conversation, and maybe it will ring a bell in your mind, and you'll be motivated to write something about this. He said, I've spoken with many people, unknown people like yourself, people in high positions. He said, I travel, I go around, I talk to people. I've never found out who this man is. I have a feeling
is he still around, do you think?
There in Germany all throughout World War II.
He must be dead by now, Jim.
Oh, yeah. Long dead. He may have had something to do with the regime in Germany. He may have been involved himself in medical research. I don't know. My guess is that he was, and that this was his attempt at redemption.
Yeah, he was cleansing himself.
Right, exactly. He was trying to cleanse himself. So, if we fast forward to 1987, which would be roughly 28 years later, I am now working as a reporter, started in 1982.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm writing my first book, which is AIDS, Inc., doing all kinds of research, meeting all manner of people. And a friend of mine in Santa Monica, who since passed away, a very wonderful guy, hypnotherapist named Jack True, introduced me to a number of people he said I needed to talk to about the book. And then one day he said to me, and by the way, when the book came out, Jack was a very, in some aspects, mysterious guy. He said to me, your book is in a diplomatic pouch headed for the Soviet Union. I said, what? He said, I have some friends. There's people over there that are interested in your findings about HIV, this, that, and the other thing. So he was this kind of guy, very mysterious in some respects.
Hmm.
One day he said to me, while I was still researching the book, he said, there's somebody I want you to talk to. You've been visiting the UCLA Biomed Library to do a lot of research, so just go over there this afternoon and somebody will find you. I was over there. This was not an unusual statement on his part, because I met lots of people through him. I was in the stacks way back there looking at some old medical journals.
Waiting for someone to show up.
Yeah, somebody did show up. And this guy knew who I was, and he said, I'm a genetics researcher, molecular biologist. He said, I'm not really here to talk to you about your book. He said, I'm here to talk to you about other things. So if you have some time, let's go someplace quiet and sit down. We found a little table deep in the stacks in Biomed Library, sat down. He said, I want to talk to you about genetic research because this is a story that's going to be here forever. And at some point, you may want to write about it. Almost, in a sense, the same kind of conversation.
Like the other guy.
Yeah, exactly, like the other guy. So, you know, everything, my sensors were on alert. I said, sure, let's chat. So we sat down.
And you trusted these people, didn't you?
Well, this second guy, I eventually was able to check up on and discover that, indeed, he was a biologist. He was a geneticist. He was working in a prominent U.S. lab doing genetic research on human genes, not plant genes. So I was able to confirm this eventually, okay, about a month after we had this conversation. And so I knew he was legit. He said, the first thing I want to tell you is that this is 1987. He said, all of the biotech research into genes as the cause of human illness is a complete boondoggle. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, it's a money game. He said, there are a lot of startup companies. They need to raise money.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know what they're doing. It's all based on hope and gossip and rumor and
a chance.
Chance. A lot. That's a great word, George, because a lot of it is really chance. It's like pin the tail on the donkey. You know, here we have all these genes, and we say, well, maybe it's this one, or maybe it's this cluster, or whatever. He said, in the service of raising all this capital, he said, and we're talking about accumulating hundreds of millions, billions of dollars that are flowing into coffers here. Some of it government money, some of it private investment. The scientists are being used in the dog and pony show. They're going out on the road. They're talking to these people. They're hyping stories.
Yeah.
All of this kind of thing. He said, you need to be aware of that because you're going to see articles making all kinds of claims about connections between disease and this gene and that gene and so on. He said, read them carefully and you will see that somewhere down in the article it will say that there is no treatment yet available, the scientists are not positive. Forget the headline, just look and you'll see.
And these companies during that time, John, they were all going public. They didn't have earnings. They were obtaining, as you said, hundreds of millions of dollars in capital. It was insane.
It was completely insane. And this is what he said. And I said, well, you say that you work in this field. He said, why do you think I'm here talking to you? Because I know you've done some good work writing for LA Weekly. You're getting into medical subjects. And he said, I read a few pages of, you know, your manuscript on the book. And he said, this is why I'm telling you this, because there are a lot of scientists that are trapped in this system, a money system. And he said, I'm not the only one by any stretch of the imagination that knows that this is a boondoggle, that nobody knows for certain what they're doing, but they're raising lots of money to do it. The second point he made was, he said, the idea that you can match one gene to one disease as the cause, he said, is a total fraud. No one has that capability. And he said, I predict that in the coming decade or two, claims will be made, mm-hmm. but they will still be fraudulent.
And they are making these claims.
They are making these claims. And yet, everything he said to me has proven out, because I have read many, many articles promoting this idea, but always somewhere you'll see treatment is not approved. We don't have a treatment yet. We're not sure. We treated one guy, and he recovered this, that, and the other thing, but nothing amounting to any sort of scientific certainty. So then the final shoe dropped in that conversation.
And you're taking notes when that's going on?
Yeah, I'm taking notes. I'm listening to him. He's watching me take notes. We're sitting at this little metal table that they have in the back of the stacks there at UCLA. Very quiet, nobody around anywhere. Hardly anybody ever goes in the places I was going to look at these medical journals from 1952, you know, bound in volumes, and take the elevator down to the cellar to get there. So we're sitting there. I'm taking notes. And he says, okay, now here's the thing. This whole human genetics program is a continuation of Nazi research. Then the bell rang in my mind. Then I was back in 1959, sitting in that penthouse, hearing that conversation. He said, this is what the tradition is. He said, now it's not restricted to Germany, he said, because the United States, there were groups in the United States and researchers that were very, very active in the eugenics program in the 20s, the 30s, and so on. He said, so it's not limited to Germany by any means.
We just never heard about it.
Which we've never heard about. But, and he was right about that, too, because there was a tremendous, as I've discovered since, communication across the water going on between certain American researchers and groups in the United States that were promoting eugenics in the 20s and 30s and Nazi researchers in Germany.
Were they collaborating with each other?
They were sharing information.
Well, that's collaborating.
Yeah, collaborating, exactly. And there were even one or two awards given out of Germany to American scientists for research in this area.
I wonder if they, even during the war, I wonder if they did that.
Well, that's another question, you know, and I think that there probably was. I mean, I can't nail that down for sure with, you know, who it was exactly, but my sense is that it never stopped. So I said, well, what is the gist of what you're trying to say here with this last point that you're making? He said, well, look, you've got to ask yourself a bunch of questions. He said, I'm not going to feed everything to you, but ask yourself if this whole human genetics program that's expanding like wildfire in the United States now is really, in a major sense, the continuation of Nazi research. Then what is the goal?
Good point.
Why is this being done?
Why is it being done? What are they trying to accomplish?
What are they trying to accomplish? And I said, well, I said, from what you're saying here, what you're suggesting, and I remember kind of a chill going up my spine, I said, you're essentially telling me that the medical research into genes as causes of human illness is a cover story. That's the smoke. But behind it, although most, I mean, if not all of the researchers don't really understand what this is for, is the real purpose of this research, which is to somehow alter human genetics and create a different kind of human.
Or what about extinguish certain types of people?
Yes, that arose later. That arose with the next scientist that I met 7 years later, that whole question. So he smiled at me and he nodded and he said, you follow up that track. That's where you need to go if you want to really understand this story.
Stay with us, John. We're going to come back with you in just a moment as we talk about the ownership of all life, genetic manipulation. Fascinating story. We'll be right back. And John, let me ask you, with the title of your book, The Ownership of All Life, is it possible to own life?
Yes, indeed. And we'll definitely get into that because people can patent human genes and also sequences, which they have done. About a quarter of the genes that were discovered in the Human Genome Project have now been patented. And there's a great legal battle going on right now to determine on what grounds you may or may not patent a gene. You have to say that you're going to use it for something, but you know, you can phrase that in general terms. Or we want to improve kidney function,
right.
So
right.
This sort of thing. So it's hard to say what's going to fly in a courtroom, but these genes and patent pendings for these genes, many of them have been patented, and that's how...
How bizarre, isn't it? I mean, the mere fact that they discovered them, they claim they own them?
Yes, they own them. And in fact, there was a court case in which a guy who had leukemia was operated on in a university hospital in California, and they took some of the blood out, and they kept it, and they formed some, you know, genetic information from it, and they used it to produce proteins, and he didn't even know about it. So he sued them, and there was a huge amount of money involved, and he lost. The university won. So these things are happening all the time. In fact, you've got drug companies, I mean, if you look at plant life going all over the world, looking at plants, you know, for drugs and patenting everything they can get their hands on. There has been patented patents formed from cells, hair, skin, etc., of so-called vanishing, quote, primitive cultures in certain parts of the world, and critics of this call it the Vampire Project. So this is ongoing. And the second scientist that I met in 1994, who was referred to me by the first one, tuned me in on this and said, this is happening now, and it's accelerating, and you're going to see a lot more of it. And there will be legal battles over the conditions under which you can get patents, but they're doing it, and they're going to continue to do it. This is a guy that I met in 1994 while I was running for Congress in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
The first scientist turned me on to him. He came back. We spoke. He handed me a folder with a CV, a resume on this second scientist. He said, I want to pass you along to this man. He is a molecular biologist, geneticist. And I was running for Congress at the time in L.A. I was giving a talk and went down to a parking lot, Santa Monica Beach. And there he was. I had his photo. He knew who I was.
He wasn't hiding.
He wasn't hiding. We walked around the parking lot for about an hour. And to bring up the point that you mentioned earlier, he gave me a sheet with a quote from an interview in Newsday, newspaper, January 9, 1994. The statement, verbatim, which I pulled, is, what is called for here is not genocide, the killing off of the population of incompetent cultures, but we do need to think realistically in terms of phasing out of such peoples. Evolutionary progress means the extinction of the less competent. That's a quote from Richard Lynn at the University of Ulster, interviewed by Newsday, January 9, 1994. He said, you get the picture here? He had other quotes as well. And you can find a number of these quotes at a website called the Center for Genetics and Society. I'm saving up the best one for a little bit later. But so we began to talk, and he said, I know now that you know about Farben, I.G. Farben. You know about Mengele and his experiments at Auschwitz, and you certainly know that Farben supported Auschwitz and that a lot of research was done under their auspices there. He said, now here's the thing that you need to understand. Farben began to believe, because it was so successful as a chemical cartel in producing dyes, plastics, materials of all kinds.
Were they based just in Germany at that time?
They were, but they had agreements all over the world before the outbreak of the Second World War. They had agreements with DuPont, with Dow, with a company, a big corporation in England called ICI, Rhône-Poulenc in France. I mean, they were everywhere. They had many, Standard Oil, of course. They had many, many, many commercial agreements and connections. So they were essentially the fourth largest corporation in the world at the time. And the constituent corporations at that time were major ones, were Bayer, BASF, and Hecht.
Was there a Merck at the time?
I believe there was. And there may have been a connection there, but I couldn't swear to it. So he said, their brilliant success was in synthesizing products from other materials. He said, this is turning into now, or had turned into, a perverted form of alchemy, because scientists at Farben began to get the idea that they were going to be able to synthesize anything and everything from anything. They would be able to take an element or a compound and transform it into something else, and the prospects were unlimited.
Whether it was the willow bark to make aspirin or whatever.
Whatever. Well, I mean, their mania was without boundaries. They believed that in the future, they would, you know, you would put down, you know, lead, they would turn it into gold. You would put down, water, they would find a way to combine it with something else and make some material that nobody had ever seen before. They were riding on this incredible high at the outbreak of World War II. He said, do you get that picture? This is a very intense guy. He said, do you understand what I'm saying? I said, yeah, I do. He said, well, think about that plus now what the Nazi agenda was. They wanted to create the new human being.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to synthesize a new human being from the old human being. That was the plan. They were going to create the new master race. He said, so you're talking about here a complete joining together of this corporate cartel interest of Farben and Hitler and his inner circle. And he said, again, reiterating what this guy, the first scientist, had told me 7 years before, he said, that plan is alive today.
I don't think they would have permitted any baby to be born in Germany, John, without being genetically altered.
I believe that if they had won the war, that's exactly what they would have proceeded to do. And Farben would have been in the forefront of that. I mean, that would have been the plan.
They would have injected the mother. Who knows what they would have done? But I'm sure every born child would have been genetically altered to fit into their scheme of the master race.
Exactly. I mean, and the thing that, because I've read some of the documents now from the medical experiments, these guys, I mean, were insane beyond insane. They didn't care what they did. They didn't care what the results of the experiments were.
I mean, I would like to know, not for morbid curiosity, but the things that went awry, things that went wrong, they must have been horrible.
Oh, yeah. It was just absolutely horrendous. I mean, people developing horrible diseases that they hadn't had before, or the exacerbation of diseases they already had, like tuberculosis. They were trying out experimental vaccines. They were injecting people with all kinds of chemicals.
I mean, did they end up with four-armed babies, two-headed babies, things like that?
You know, that's possible. I think that so many of the people that they experimented on died in the camps, the prison camps,
right,
that I'm not sure how, you know, whether there were future generations or not, although I'm not putting it past Farben and the regime there, because they were willing, as I say, to do anything. And who knows what may have been exported out of there. I mean, there's all kinds of speculation, which I'm trying to avoid. I mean, boys from Brazil and all of that kind of stuff.
Well, but that's possible.
But it's absolutely possible, because there is, I believe, credible information that at least suggests that Mengele survived the war and that he did go to South America to continue his experiments. And if that's true, then they certainly would have been genetic experiments. He wasn't there to try to cure diseases. It was all about, for him, the new genetics and the new human being. So then this geneticist pointed out to me, he said, you have to understand that the early eugenics movement in the United States, the research, was funded by the Rockefeller, Carnegie, and Harriman families. He said they were instrumental in favoring the idea of eugenics, which was favorable people survive generation to generation and unfavorables don't. I said, okay, and I eventually confirmed that independently, that that was true, that those families had funded major eugenics research in the United States. And then the last bomb that he dropped in that conversation was, he said, what's going to happen now is, this is 1994, he said, the Human Genome Project. I said, yes, I've heard of it. I said, started in 1989, right? He said, yes. He said, when they finish it, what you're not going to hear about, but what will undoubtedly take place secretly, out of view, is that they will, certain scientists will begin to try to create a genetic profile of the, quote, superior human being. That will be the long-term consequences of the Human Genome Project. It will not be publicized. It will not be on television. There will be no newspaper articles about it, but it will happen. And it will happen compartmentalized in different labs around the world. Many scientists will have no knowledge of what they're really working on. But this project, he said, I just want you to understand, is still alive. It did not end with the end of the Second World War.
Did they plan to make money doing this, John, or was there that other picture?
Well, I think that the money that's planned to be made is in the disease research, you see, and that's a shell game. I mean, that's, we're here, we're almost here, we think we know, yeah, maybe, you know, we need more money. The government is now on board with this, and as, you know, government grants of large amounts of money, private investors, and so on.
I mean, look at how many billions of dollars Jerry Lewis has raised for muscular dystrophy over the years,
yeah,
you know, every Labor Day. And, you know, you give him credit, but, I mean, they're no closer. They're really no closer.
And that's a good point, because you see how willing people are to shell out money for something which, you know, objectively, nobody can prove is any closer to a result than it was, say, 15, 20, 30 years ago. So in the same way with genetics research, because the PR on it has been so fantastic, you know, this is the basis of all human life.
Yes.
This is the basic cause of all disease.
We're going to be able to isolate everything. We're going to know, for example, this little child. We're going to know if that little child is going to grow up and have heart problems when they become an adult. So we're going to cure it and take care of it right now when they're a little infant. That's what they want to do.
Or even in the fetus.
Right, exactly.
They're going to inject genes. You know, there's three basic ways. I mean, you can put new genes in. You can knock out genes. You can, you know, change genetic structure. There's all kinds of ways of trying to deal with this. And I've read some technical papers and talked to scientists about this. And the gist is, this is gossip, rumor, chance, as you said. We think we know. Let's get some papers written. As one researcher told me recently, let's cook up some statistical evidence using computer models that shows that we're closer than we were 5 years ago. Let's get the paper published. Let's get some more funding in here. You know, and then eventually, to cap all of this off, I met a year later the third and the final scientist that I talked to. This was now 1995. And I was passed along to him by this second scientist. And we had a meeting. And he expanded on everything that I had learned up to that point. He was another geneticist. I confirmed, saw his resume, confirmed his name and where he worked, and so on. And he was under tremendous strain, which you could see written all over him, because he saw where all of this was going. He was employed to contribute to it himself.
He was making his livelihood in it.
Exactly. Everything, you know, the car payments, the house, the college for the kids.
Yep.
I mean,
he was trapped. He was trapped
totally in this. And he was very smart, very bright, very competent. And he knew what was going on. And he said, you know, you've got to find a forum where you can make this clear as to what's really happening. We met in a bookstore in Santa Monica in 1995. We walked down the street, Santa Monica Boulevard, all the way to the ocean, walked south. We talked for a couple of hours. And the first thing that he confirmed, expanded on, was he said, the PR campaign is everything. The propaganda is everything. The campaign is to make the engineering of human beings acceptable on the basis of the promise of cures of disease.
Yes. And who wouldn't accept that, right?
Yeah.
We'd all like that.
I mean, exactly. See, I mean, everybody is roped in on this one. I mean, you see people, you know, desperately ill, and somebody says, well, we have an experimental gene treatment. I'll take it. Give it to me now, whatever I have to do, you know. And the PR on this is relentless. If you start to look at newspapers, internet, mainstream media, science, journalism, so forth, medical journalism, and begin to look at these stories in a different way, you will see that the propaganda is endless and it's intense and on and on and on and on it goes.
John, last week I had physicist Michio Kaku on, and he talked about by 2050, we should be able to live to 150 years old. And I don't agree with that for most people. I think if we live to 150, they're going to want it, these elitists, for themselves. They're not going to want the unemployed, the poor, people who are troublemakers to live to 150. There's no way.
Oh, well, this is now exactly the point that this third scientist made to me. He said, look, make a new human. What does that mean? He said, first of all, you've got basically three classes. The super yuppie, as he put it, he said, high IQ, very high IQ, good looks, talent. Those are the basics. Good health, of course, not susceptible to major diseases.
Mm-hmm.
Then he said, the cold warriors, as he put it.
Let's get into all of that when we come right back. John Rappaport, our special guest tonight, as we talk about his work, The Ownership of All Life. We'll be back.